Sober on Purpose is the podcast that takes you beyond clean to fulfilling your dreams. Other programs get you sober. We ask, what's next? Come thrive with us.
Welcome, Sober on Purpose family. I have some wonderful guests for us today. This really is a family episode, and we're actually shooting this the day before Thanksgiving, so it has that real family feel to it. I have with me Jared Davis and Lisa Mead, who wrote together a mother-son book around recovery from addiction before there was an after. Welcome, Jared and Lisa.
Thank you for having
us. Thanks for having us, yeah.
Well, I just, as I said, I just finished reading the book. I have so many questions. I'm not even sure where to start. But one line that you wrote, Lisa, really struck home for me early on was, "My son was a hopeless heroin addict. I failed."
Yes. Yeah. It's a, as anyone who's been a, has a loved one going through addiction, anyone in your family, friends, it is a constant feeling of failure. You take it on yourself as if you can fix it. And I think that is a important message to get across from the families. It's not your failure and it's not yours to fix. And I think that that took me 7 years to get to that point, because it feels very much like your own failure. There must have been something you could have done differently. And I think that's the interesting thing in the book. I learned a lot in the book. We didn't write the chapters together. I would write a book, send it to him, a chapter, and he would write it back. And there were many, many things I learned. And there were moments that he gave me the grace to forgive myself, that it wasn't my fault. So I think it's really important to have that perspective from Jared.
So Jared, when your mom in the book says she had been asking you to write, to do diary pieces, to do these things, as you're going through this process, what are you thinking when she says, "Here's a journal"?
Yeah. I mean, it took me a long time to get on board with writing this story, right? Because it was hard to like go back and look at these details of my life where, you know, where I wasn't proud of, you know, wasn't very proud of what I was doing or how I was treating my family especially. So it was hard for the first couple of years to even, you know, get this writing underway. So, and to really like deep, you know, dive in and dig down and like look at these details of my life and how I really showed up, and you know, but it was very freeing to get all that stuff out, especially in the hopes of like helping other families, right? Of being able to reach out and support others that are going through the same situation. When, because I remember the feeling of not feeling like anybody understood what was going on, mm-hmm. And thinking that I was all alone. I think that's a big mistake that a lot of us make when we're on this journey. I mean, any part of journey, really. But yeah, like being able to connect with other families was really the thing that drove this home and like why I wanted to do it.
And what Lisa said later on is, everything you know about being a good parent is the opposite of what you need to do.
Yeah, that was, and I think it's particularly difficult for moms and dads, and it doesn't mean that not everyone has that, but, you know, I think I say, if you'd gotten a manual with your baby, which none of us get, right, on how to raise a kid, you know, you'd have to forget all of that, because if there was a chapter on addiction, it would be, it is not your job to feed them and clothe them and make sure that they're safe, and that, you know, gets to be our focus when we can't control anything else. If I can just keep him alive, you know, it's my job to make sure that he is safe. And that allowed him to stay an addict even longer, because I was finding him a place to live, running around like a crazy person, making sure I couldn't possibly not get him food. I couldn't possibly not make sure he had healthcare or clothing or whatever his needs were. And somehow, you also think if you can show them that normalcy, that will be enough, that there'll be an epiphany, right? And they won't be an addict anymore. I don't want to live like this. And those are really hard lessons, because it doesn't matter if they're 15 or 25, your instinct as a parent, you know, kicks in to try to take care of them. And certainly you can fix this like you fixed all their other problems when they were young. And it is what prolongs that enabling forever and ever and ever. And they manipulate that. They're very good at keying in on mom guilt and and again, what did I do wrong? And he was very good at it. And you know, if I had just stopped earlier, it wasn't until I did say, I'm not going to support you as long as you're using, if you want to get sober, I'll pick you up anytime, anywhere, 24/7. And that was that text that I used to send him over. But it took me years to feel like I can't leave him. I can't leave him out on the street. I can't just leave him homeless. I can't just not let him eat. And I had family members that thought it was a horrible thing that I, you know, when he was homeless, that I said, you know, this is really hard for me. You have to support me. I've got to just let him figure it out, because his rock bottom and my rock bottom were completely different. I thought he hit rock bottom about 25 times. And, you know, I can't define what his rock bottom is. So it's the point again of the book, and hopefully people seeing the process you have to go through yourself, because you have to get there yourself. People can tell you that. You know, you have to have boundaries. And it's like, what does that mean exactly as a mom? I don't know boundaries as a mom. So it's your own process. It's your own battle to get there.
And Jared, as you're experiencing your life, because you were an adult when all of this began to really deteriorate, as you were experiencing your life, what were you thinking and what were you thinking you needed? There's a motorcycle accident, which is kind of the inciting incident for a lot of this. What were you thinking you needed?
Yeah, I just remember having such a victim mentality, especially after my motorcycle accident, that like I, for whatever reason, I had it in my head that the world owed me something and I could do whatever I wanted to feel okay. And you couldn't hold that against me. And then just being able to like manipulate my mom, especially, but like just anybody around me, being able to use that motorcycle accident to get away with whatever I wanted. And it's like, I just wanted to be able to do what I wanted to do. And I didn't really think about who I was hurting at any time. You know, it wasn't about anybody else, right? What I came to find out is like how selfish I was being in the moment, even though I didn't think I was. Right, I felt like the world had done me wrong, right? And how could I be selfish when I got this bad hand? But I didn't realize like how I was taking that out on my family members, on my friends, on my daughter. You know, I didn't realize that I was just consuming everything and making it their problem, right? And it took me years and years of therapy and like trying to figure that out and, you know, getting sober and all that stuff to like really see the damage that I caused. So I wanted my motorcycle accident not to happen. And that's all I could focus on. I wanted to not be dealt that hand, right? And I didn't think it was fair. And I really showed that through my actions, right? And I wasn't fair with a lot of people in my life because of that.
I have to tell you that, Tanya, when I talked to people, it was interesting, his perspective, because it feels like it's being done to you and they could stop for you if they wanted to. And I think that's an important message, that when I would read his chapters, it was, and talk to him later, you know, there's a saying, you know, they give up everything for one thing, you know, in this case, heroin, but there isn't a thought of, you know, how can I manipulate my mom today? Or, you know, what is this doing to her? It is such a selfish act. You know, you're so consumed with just what's going on with yourself that it's not being done to you. And I tell that to a lot of families. And again, it's not your fault. They're not punishing you. It's not that they know exactly what you're going through. And I think Jared, when he read the chapters, when I wrote the first chapter, which wasn't chapter one in the book, I think it was three, he read it and I didn't talk to him for a few days. And he said, you know, I really either forgot or didn't realize how hard this was on the family. It wasn't top of mind. It wasn't what I was thinking is, oh my God, what am I doing to my family? It isn't what he was thinking about.
In earlier chapters, Jared, you write, I was quieting my mind with weed. That this wasn't against anybody. This was almost a self-preservation
piece. It was for sure. I mean, especially after my motorcycle accident, it was all self-preservation. Like my emotions turned up to a point where I couldn't hear the word. I couldn't function, right? I couldn't think clearly at all. And what I used in the beginning, you know, the opiates, the weed, the whatever, was really to quiet my mind and my emotions, because I was feeling so much, you know, and I didn't like it. What I found with opiates in general, like, not only did it take away my physical pain, it took away my emotional pain as well. So there was just nothing there to experience, which was a great place to be at that time. Right. But I just didn't expect it to bleed over into, you know, 7 years later, and all the damage that ensued after that. But I used it to survive for sure at first.
And one of the things that your mom talks about in her chapter is, this was before we really understood opiates and what was happening in the medical field, and even before the doctors really understood what was going on. What would you say to people, you know, say somebody has a major accident, you are going to use some pain medications. What would you say to people now about these pain medications?
I mean, take it as prescribed and don't take it for long. You'd be surprised. I mean, I've gone through some painful events, right? I've been sober for almost 6 years. So I've had times when I've had to use Tylenol, right? Mm-hmm. And it's amazing how much Tylenol or ibuprofen works when you're not doing opiates at all, yeah. Right? So like the power of that, but also like just a very short time scale is what I would say. Like you only need it while it's unbearable. And get off of it as quick as you can, because it just starts this cycle that you can't get out of, because it's a physically dependent drug as well. So like once you get past that point, like you're going to physically need that and want it. And it starts this crazy cycle.
Well, I'll tell you, I work in the medical field, and I am, you know, we're working, we have an ambulatory surgery center. We're going to be the first in the state that offers a opioid-free surgery starting next year. It is really hard because people don't want to be in pain. I work in orthopedics, and it's painful surgery. And his brother had a really bad knee injury this summer, and had never had surgery before, never been on opioids. And you don't know who the people are that are predisposed. There's no way, there's not a test to say, you know, there's these 10 questions they will ask if you're dealing with depression and all of those kinds of things, but there's no way to really know who is going to take that Percocet for the first time and go, oh my God, this is amazing. If I have to take them, I feel terrible. I want to get off of them as quickly as possible. But when his brother lives in Montana. I brought him back to Reno to have his surgery because he needed two specialists to repair his knee. And he was asking about pain pills. I said, give him 3 days. He goes, Lisa, there's no way. This is a big surgery. He's going to have it. I said, he doesn't know any different, and I have no way of knowing if he's predisposed like his brother. There's no way for me to know that. So we've got ice machines. We'll cycle Tylenol and ibuprofen. We'll keep the, you know, the opioids. And they started out with oxycodone. I said, let's knock it down to hydrocodone. And then, you know, we'll try to keep it at night. And I didn't tell his brother, but I had no way to know. But it is often interesting. It's the patient that is, you know, afraid and wants to make sure they have the pain pills. And as Jared said, you need to say, try it for 3 days and try something else. You don't have to take the whole bottle. You know, just if you don't need it, don't take it. And there is that whole thing, chase the pain, you know, don't allow the pain to get ahead of you. And that was, you know, infamous Purdue Pharma, where you, with the happy and sad faces, you know, what's your pain level? And don't let the pain get away from you. So make sure you're taking it as soon as you wake up and keep taking it. And it's a frustrating process. We're trying to come up with a system that supports physicians to give alternatives to patients, because patients get upset. They don't want to be in pain. And doctors need another way to offer. We can offer you some pain-free. We're doing what they call blocks right now, and blocking the nerve and allowing them to come back in, and we're working towards that. It's still a problem. Dental surgery, it doesn't matter. Plastic surgery, dental surgery, or any kind of surgery, the first thing they do is write you a prescription to get you out of the pain. And so It's the doctors I work for were very interested in the book because I said you guys.
It was the beginning of the end,
and it
is what
is.
You said.
And it is, it's a such a frustrating process that I get what they're trying to do. Their mission is to do no harm and make sure that the patient is taken care of. And you don't want them to be in pain, but there has to be a way. In Jared's case, for example, they still don't test people to see if they're using recreational marijuana or, you know, any drugs, because that should change whether or not and what you prescribe. It's just an automatic thing. And they knew me. And so with my youngest son, I could have gotten anything. They would have said, you know, what do you want for pain for him? And I said, well, I want the least that he can have. But they would have written it for anything for me. And so it's still a problem out there. And we have to support physicians in giving people choices that do, you know, actually address the pain without narcotics. And that's one of my big goals in the next few years, is to really push that. I have a friend who's an anesthesiologist in Michigan who got a lot of legislation done in the state of Michigan. And so we're going to try to mimic that here in Nevada.
So the key is you have choices and you need to do your research.
Yeah.
And you can stop. It's not like the antibiotics where they say, take these for 10 days or you could be back. You could be back in here with us. It is stop.
Especially if you've never had surgery and you've never taken them, because it doesn't matter if you're 15 or 50, if you're predisposed, you know, you don't know that until you take them. And so, you know, do your homework, limit yourself, you know, there's lots of other things you can do to deal with the pain, because there's no way for you to know, you know, if it's going to be you that feels amazing on them, and it releases that serotonin. It feels awesome and feels normal. For some people, they say it's the first time I felt normal. I think Jared says that in the book. When he took Roboxone, the liquid Roboxone, he thought, my God, if I could feel like this forever, life would be perfect. And I take it, and it was like, oh my gosh, I have a rebound headache. I'm nauseous. I'm like everything.
So it's the chemistry of the human body that we all have a single thumbprint, fingerprint, and it just is different for all of us. One of the things that really got me in the book was, you know, you have an addict and they get sober. You said, I didn't understand about the journey.
Yeah.
What were the most, this is going to be an interesting question, what were the most unhelpful things from either one of you that were happening in the journey?
Oh boy, there's so many. I will tell you that I think that there's, you know, there's an enormous lack of support. There is, I think there's a lot of people that are well-intentioned. So you have extremes in recovery, and you have the physician who can open an office and hand out Suboxone and make a fortune on something like Medicaid with no counseling, nothing other than you have to show up. That's kind of the legal requirement, and write a prescription, which he went through. No support, you know, it's awful. Same with the methadone clinic. You show up here, you get it. There isn't a lot of, that one had a little bit more support. I think how difficult the way that the detox defines who needs help and who doesn't. That whole assessment process, which I think we went through it 5 or 6 times before I realized that there is a diagnosis code in that they have to come up with by asking these ridiculous questions to a homeless heroin addict, you know, that I thought were so absurd. And so I can't imagine anybody says, please put me in rehab, that isn't an addict. So this idea that you have to go through an assessment, once you get the assessment, you hope you can find them to get them into detox. Once they detox, then you have to find a place to put them. And there's never a bed, so you start this cycle over and over again. And so in between, you try to use methadone clinics and Suboxone clinics. And there is no, the journey should be beginning to end, as it was for him in the end, an actual process of treatment and counseling and all of that together, that is a continuum. So this concept of 30-day programs just makes me cuckoo in that it is such a process to get someone in. You know, you can go to an emergency room if you have any other health concern and get admitted right away and, you know, get a team of people to help you. I always said if he'd had cancer, it would have been a village of people trying to help me. It is hard enough to support them because it tears families apart. And then when they do want to get sober, the amount of work it takes for the family to find some place, to come up with the financials, to deal with, are you kidding me? And I'd love to say there were a lot of well-intentioned people on the journey. It's very mechanical in some ways, and the system is overwhelmed. And so I think, you know, the other is from a fan, you know, from family and friends. Well, you know, why doesn't he just stop for his daughter? And I thought, yeah, I'll try that one. You have a lot of, again, well-intentioned on that side. And it's gotten a little better in the state of Nevada, but it was very few beds, very hard to get, anyone to take you seriously. People are just tired. EMTs are tired of revitalizing, people with Narcan. The police are tired of dealing with overdose. And so it's just, you don't feel very supported. And there's very few people that know how to help. So almost nothing was helpful in the whole process. And then again, you can't talk to people about it. If you mentioned it, and I would try to talk to people at times, they wanted out of that room as fast as possible.
It's very scary.
It's very, it's scary, very scary to people. And they just, they almost crawl out of the room. And you were like, okay, well, so you end up saying, how's he doing? Oh, he's fine. I didn't want to go into, let's see. He stole my mom's debit card and, he's disappeared again. And, blah, blah. That fear is unhelpful. I read something one time where if you have a friend or family member that is going through something, just sit with it, make eye contact. You don't have to say anything, but don't make them feel ashamed for bringing it up. I think there's a lot of people that shame families. And I think that's why they don't talk about it. There's somehow we can fix it or something that we did. And so that idea that if somebody does come to you, the most helpful thing you can do is just be there, make eye contact. You don't have to say anything. You can say, I know nothing about it. What can I help you with? That would have been really helpful anywhere in the medical system, family, friends. That would have been amazing. So
just that holding space, kind of like you would with somebody who's grieving.
It's exactly,
I can't fix this for you, but I can sit next to you.
Just sit next to me and just say, and I was fortunate. I had a few friends that were amazing, but there were many people you lose in your life because it's very consuming. You're spending an enormous amount of time trying to work, take care of the rest of your family and deal with this constant fear of him dying. And, it is just sometimes just someone gently saying, are you taking care of yourself? How are you doing? I've talked to families at the where he went for his final rehab. And, when they're there, it's like, take a vacation, breathe, just take care of yourself because your whole life is in turmoil all the time. And that's hard for people to understand. So yes, just hold space and be there for people. There may be nothing you can do, but we do rely on those few that did help us feel safe and okay about it. So that's the best advice, I think.
Yeah.
Go ahead. Sorry.
Yeah, it's just the lack of connection. I mean, I remember being in that position, right, and trying to talk to people about doing heroin and like whatever it was to get Suboxone or whatever. And people just look at you differently and treat you differently for the most part. There was a few along the way that were really nice, but for the most part, you're just like a monster in their eyes. You're like, I'm not trying to be this way. I don't want to be this way, right? Mm-hmm. But it is. It's hard to get help when you want it, genuine help from people. I think we need more compassion or education on just like what's happening, because I'm not trying to, as an addict, I'm not trying to damage and destroy the lives around me. Right? It's not my intention. I'm just in a position where I have a disease, right? And I don't know how to get out of it. I don't know how to ask for help. I don't know how to do anything. I don't know how to live life correctly at this point. So when you start asking for help and like trying to figure out how to detox and how to get to rehab and all this stuff, there's so many hurdles that I just like, I would give up several times before I even got to where I needed to be. And I found through my experience, like my willingness to change was very small, right? These little times that would come to pass, like where I was down and out, homeless on the streets, whatever it was, I would have this little moment where I was like, yeah, I want to do something different right now. And if I would let that go on for a little bit, it would completely change, right? If I tried to talk to one person that treated me badly, if I tried to like talk to a family member that didn't treat me right, like I would just instantly go back to that position of like, oh, nobody cares. I'll just go back to what I was doing before, because that's the easier option, right? So the fact that it's not very easy to get the help that you need makes it difficult. And that at that time in Nevada, it was really hard to get help. Like mom was just talking about, like it was really hard to find people that really even cared or even knew what they were dealing with.
It sounded by reading the book, and I hope all the listeners grab the book. It tells a lot in a very short frame. It sounded very dehumanizing for you, Jared, that the questions were always the same. It was always like this. And if he didn't tick all the boxes, then there was no hope for help.
Yeah. And I remember just like saying these things that would freak most people out. Right. Like, but I would say them so much that it just became normal to me. Mm-hmm. But like talking about using needles or like whatever, like these other people, just like their eyes would widen, just like, oh my God, what is this? And, you know, and it made me feel like a monster most of the time, just trying to get help, which was unfortunate. That was hard for me for sure, to be able to just like honestly talk about what's really going on and not people, you know, not having people just like, whoa, I don't know what to do with that.
What was helpful from family members, or what could they have done when you needed to talk?
So here's the funny thing about that. It is like, what I wanted was like just for them to sign my bullshit and
there's your word.
Yeah, there's the word. Clean. But I wanted them to sign off on whatever I was doing, right? And I wanted them to, you know, make my suffering easier and all this stuff. What really helped me in the end was my mom finally wisened up and was like, I cannot help you anymore. And let me go to like that place of, you know, no return, basically. Like she had a text message that was very robotic, right? It would said the same thing. I would text her from different phones or whatever it was, and she would always send the same text message back. Like, I am unwilling to help you unless you want to go get sober. I will take you to rehab whenever you want. You know, and I would say things like, oh, you're not even going to feed me. You're not even going to give me a place to stay. I'm freezing out here. I'm starving. I would use all those tactics, right? So what I actually wanted was not what I needed. Mm-hmm. In my head. So the things that I wanted was, you know, love and support, obviously. But I really wanted to be able to use like I was using and not have to deal with things and be comfortable, you know. But what I really needed in the end was boundaries, right? And, you know, I needed my mom to set down those boundaries to be able to move forward, because I wasn't going to do it on my own. There was no way, you know. And that's when we're talking about this family disease, right? Because we feed off of each other, you know. We've created this sick relationship to where my mom enabled me for a really long time. My other, you know, other family members did that too. But once they cut that off, like it made me, you know, squirm and struggle and actually ask for help in the real way. You know, even though it took several attempts to do that, but it started to plant the seed like, hey, I need to ask for something else here. Like I need to figure out what's really going on, because what I'm doing isn't working.
I think it takes so long to believe that they are not in this case, the person you raised and the person you knew. Families have to understand that you are not dealing with that child that you knew before. His, you know, he has different priorities and goals and motivations. And it, you know, I believed a lot of what he would tell me because I knew him before this, right? He didn't lie about those things. He didn't do those kinds of things. And it did take an enormous amount to realize that he's in there somewhere, and I hope he comes back, but this is not, I have to arm myself. This is not the same person. And it was a stepdad, my husband now, that would often say, you know, he would say, Lisa, you know, he would try to tell me things that were going on. And I'm like, that's just not true. Jared would never do that. And I don't believe that. And it was it's a horrible struggle for families, because there is often someone who takes it to the other extreme to try to get through to you that what you think is happening is not what's happening. And that causes tension in the family. You have, you know, siblings who feel neglected. And I hear that often from talking to families. You put so much time and energy into that problem that, you know, their problems and what's going on in their life kind of go to the wayside. And so it is really hard to see what's really going on and understand that you have to change the way you deal with them, because they are not the person you married, the person you raised, the person that was your friend. It's really hard realization. And once you make that change, they fight. There's some fights. And I was always just wanted to keep him close, so you didn't engage and call him on it, basically, to keep him kind of coming around. And it's just, like I said, it's just, you just, there's no manual for this. And it's just the opposite of what you think you need to do.
Well, and that's what you said, is you set boundaries. You didn't let go completely. You were still answering the text.
Yep.
You were still a lifeline out there as far as I still exist. You hadn't closed the door and shut Jared out of your life.
I do hear that a lot. I mean, a lot of people do. They're just done. And they think the boundary is to be done and no contact.
What would you two say about the no contact? Now, yes, there were boundaries. You couldn't stay at the house. You know, right. She said, if you weren't going to get sober, I'm not going to come pick you up or do these types of things. But where would you say about the total closeout?
I now, being on this side of it, and again, having talked to families that have made both choices, that I think I say it in the book, I do think that it is extremely hard to get sober with support. It is impossible without support. I think that what you have to do is absolutely say, this is your choice, this is your life, as long as you're using, you know, you're not part of this family. However, if you ever want to get sober, and that was the text, I will be there 24/7. I wanted him to know that I still believed in him. I still wanted him to make that choice, but it was his choice. And I would be there when he was ready. But I would tell him, I can't watch you die. My biggest fear was that he would die in an alley somewhere in a different town, and I would never know what happened to him, because of course they'd always lose their ID and their phones. And I just thought, I can't, every time you would see him, he would look sick. And, you know, I just thought, I can't watch this. And there has to be a point at which you say, I can't watch you die anymore. But if you want to get sober, I will never give up on you. And I never did. I never gave up on him. And I think you have to have that hope. What you have to realize is you can't control it. And I'm a fixer. So that was really hard to say, it's going to be up to him. He's got to ask for the help. And when he asks for the help, we have a good shot of him becoming sober, because he did it for me over and over again, over and over again. He would do it because I'm like a lot of moms, determined and relentless. And, you know, I exhausted him into going to detox. And it was like, oh my God, I don't have anywhere to go anywhere. I might as well just go to detox. It's easier than, you know, this constant barrage. And it's really hard to step back. And I've dealt with mothers now that are, you know, in it still, that have gone through the cycle of rehab and failing and, you know, relapsing. And I talked to one not long ago, and she said, you know, I'm finally at peace that it's his decision, and I hope, you know, he makes the right decision, and I've told him I'll be there if he does. But I had to let go, and it's really, really hard to do. But if you want to save their life, it is all that you can do. We cannot make that choice. We cannot fix it for them. And they will not come to it, like he said, as long as they're comfortable. We enable them to stay an addict. It's easier to do that than to get sober. And so we want to make it a lot harder to be an addict than it is to get sober. So it's a flip switch of in your brain. You really have to flip. And I'm not saying it's easy. It was 7 years it took me to do it. And I'm hopeful that anyone I talk to won't take 7 years to get there. I would love to see people in some way. It's their own journey, but any way we can support them to get there sooner. As Jared said about his stepdad, he said, you know, everyone needs a Barry in their life. I probably would have gotten sober sooner if I'd had somebody calling me on my BS, you know, because I wanted to believe him. I wanted to make him better.
Yeah.
Well, and what was it like, Jared, to know that, yes, she wasn't going to do some things, but she was still answering your text? She hadn't closed the door completely.
Oh, it was, I mean, that was everything in the end. When I think back, I know a lot of people don't get that opportunity where they have family members that stick it out to the end like that. But just the fact that the lifeline was always there, right? It was just that even though I didn't get a response and I stopped trying to get a response after a while, but I knew it was there. You know, I think there's a part in the book where I'm, you know, walking homeless on the streets, I find some change and I call her from a payphone, right? And I knew she would answer in the back of my mind and help me. So it was like always having that there. I think it's important to have that, you know, that connection. If you're lucky enough to have a family member like that, that is, you know, educated themselves and gotten to the point where they're at peace with your decisions, as long as like they're there and willing to help you when you're ready, I think made the world a difference for me in the end. Like I knew I could call her still and get the help if I wanted it. Mm-hmm. But I mean, I would also, I used that as a manipulation tactic for a long time as well. So it was like a fine line, you know, and I kept thinking in my mind, like, there's got to be a day where she just stops answering my call, right? There's just like, there's got to be a point where you're just like, no more. I don't want to talk to you anymore. But you don't remember, you don't think about the dying love of a mother, right? And loving her son. And obviously she's going to be there, you know, even though she's got to play the tough guy and give me the robotic responses. And I mean, at the end of the day, she's going to be there no matter what. Right. And, you know, I'm lucky and fortunate to have that. So I know a lot of people don't, you know, so I was very fortunate in that sense that I had a mom who wisened up to my tactics and was also supportive from a distance, right? When I was ready, she was there to do something about it. But I started seeing the truth and getting way more healthy and making attempts to get sober as soon as she did, right? As soon as she got some help and started to see the truth and talk to some friends and therapists or whatever it was, like as soon as she started to see the light, like it helped me come around to the other side as well.
So as soon as she stopped pushing and stopped trying to fix, and I'm right there with you, Lisa. I've got teenage boys. There are lots of things that I try and push and fix. But what I realized was if I don't let them grow up and be their own men, I've got a bigger problem.
You know, whenever you've had your own, you know, stuff, it's just you're so sure you can save them from, you know, going through the tough stuff. But it's going through the tough stuff that makes them their own man, right? You have to allow them to fail. And it's really hard as a mom, you know, to just allow them to fail and figure it out. You just don't want to do that. So, yeah, it's interesting in all the women in my family. I look and we were talking about what wonderful mothers we had as my mom passed away this last summer and her sisters and my grandmother. And, you know, we go the way back. But we were enablers. However, we were always there for our kids and wonderful in that. They used to say tenderhearted. We were very sensitive to how our kids felt and, you know, very much took those emotions on and tried to fix it. So, yeah, it's a tough spot to get out of, but it will also, if you stay in that cycle with the addict, you will literally exhaust, if not kill yourself mentally, physically, emotionally. You just can't keep it up.
And if I heard Jared correctly, as long as you stayed sick, you could have still chosen to get well, Jared, but her sickness affected yours and it was, you were feeding off of each other.
Yep.
Oh, 100%. Like we were the worst for each other at one time. And then we ended up being the best for each other once we figured out what it was supposed to look like, which was opposite of everything that we thought it was supposed to be, mm-hmm. right? What you think about growing up and what love is supposed to look like with your family members and like what you're supposed, how you're supposed to treat each other. All that goes out the window when you're a drug addict, right? It's like you can't love them the same way or in the same light. You know, there's different things that you have to do to get through to them or to support them. It looks a lot different than it does being, you know, just a normal person. So,
yeah. Now, you in the book, you talk about the journey, and I really encourage people to read it, of all the local help, of all the local things you did. But then you settled on something that was extensive, to say the least. How did, I know how it turns out because you're sitting here, Jared, which is just a woohoo. There are a lot of moms who don't have their sons sitting with them. Why did you stay? Why did you continue to do the program? Because it sounds like a facility that you could have walked out of at any time.
Yeah, I mean, there was a lot of motivation to be there with like all the drug charges and stuff that I got in the end. But I had finally gotten to a point where I figured out that I didn't know what I was doing and I needed help, right? That was the main thing, is like, I finally ran out of good ideas in my head. You know, I finally ran out of, I was just exhausted of manipulations and coming up with these crazy schemes and like lying to my mother to get me out of jail or like whatever it was. I was just tired of all that. I remember having the conversation with my mom in jail where I was just like, Mom, I don't care what it is. I'll do whatever you think I should do at this point. I'm done, right? Now, I didn't know that help was going to look like a year-long treatment center in Texas. But like at the time, I was just like, I don't know what to do. Like whatever you think is a good idea, I'm just going to do that. Because clearly on my own power, on my own will, I cannot figure this out. I end up homeless on the streets shooting heroin every time. So like whatever your idea is, I'm just going to go with that. And you know, that's, and when I got to the point, I felt different immediately when I got there, right? When I started to seek this higher power in my life, when I started to work the 12-step program, when I started to like look at the places that I fell short in my life and doing the steps basically and getting real clear on like my part in life and the things that I fell short on and being able to make amends and all that stuff. Like I started to feel good about myself again. And like, I felt like there was this new breath in my life. So, that, I mean, as I went on and the longer that I stuck out these hard things to deal with, like I felt better about myself for the first time. And since I was a kid, right. You know, it'd been 20-year lapse of, especially since my motorcycle accident where I had no self-esteem, I had no worth anymore. And being able to help other guys get out of this darkness as well as the, and families, you know, like being able to talk to families, especially about this book, being able to take other guys through the 12 steps and, you know, being of service in that way has built this self-esteem back to where like, yeah, I want to keep doing this because this feels good. And this is like a sustainable way to live life instead of the one that I was used to for so long. So that's really why I stayed, is like being able to have that new sense of purpose.
And this was a very comprehensive program. I love the 12 steps, but I myself have had to do EMDR and some other things. So tell us a little bit more about the comprehensiveness of this program. This wasn't just show up 90 and 90.
No, this was a very highly structured, high accountability program. So from the, everything is planned out from the second you wake up to the, you know, the second you go to bed, intensive therapy groups. So it's like from 8 to 4 every day, you're in, you know, group therapies or you're with your counselor or doing chores around the property or like you're constantly working on yourself for a year straight. Right. So there's an I did a lot of EMDR as well to process. EMDR was great because I was able to process like my motorcycle accident, some of the stuff I had, you know, relationship wise with my dad growing up, like being able to get through all that stuff. What was nice for, you know, like EMDR treatment is it takes like a long period of time to do stuff like that, like any kind of trauma work. Right. So being in a year long treatment center where I was in a safe place, right, to be able to process that stuff really helped as well. But it wasn't like an easy feel good treatment center either. It was like, hey, this is how you show up. And they would hold a mirror up and be like, this is what we see where you're falling short. This is how you manipulate. And like, it wasn't good to hear those things. And it was jarring most of the time. But like, once I saw the value in it, I was like, I wanted more of that. Right. And I started to like reevaluate how my friendships should look. For instance, like I want people to like, now I want people to point the truth out to me, even though it might hurt in the moment. Like, that's what I seek now, because I've seen that that's the most beneficial for anybody. Right. Even though it hurts in the moment, like being able to see the truth and grow from that. And, you know, learning, just relearning about emotions too. You know, I was so disheartened with emotions, right? I didn't want to feel fear. I didn't want to acknowledge that I was in fear or loneliness or shame or guilt or any of that stuff. Like, being able to sit in a place that I'm very grateful for too, like being able to really analyze why we have those emotions in the first place. There's a reason, right? And like reevaluating and putting a new aspect on like why we have these emotions has been a great, but it wasn't in, like, the treatment center I went to is not like a first one and done treatment center, right? It is geared for chronic relapsers like I was, that cannot figure out any other way to live life. So it's not something that I would recommend like anybody just sign up for right away, because there's plenty of options out there that are short term that work for people, right? Mm-hmm. 30 to 90 day programs that have worked for people, especially coupled with the 12 steps or whatever that looks like. I was just a serious case, I guess. So.
It was interesting. Because when you're a family member looking for a rehab, I mean, it's hysterical. Like, what premise do I use to pick what a good rehab is, right? And they all have kind of success rate information. And seriously, it was so bad that I picked, he was in jail, and they have drug court here in Reno, but not where he was at, Nevada. And I thought, maybe if I can find a program that can mimic that, because of course I was going to fix him again, maybe I could, you know, figure out some way to let him go to a program. And I literally am online. That's what people do. You're online looking, and I'm trying to find places close. California's close, so I looked there. My grand plan was, there was a treatment center in California that Dr. Phil sent, you know, people from his show to. I thought, okay, well, I got nothing else to go on. I'm calling it, because I didn't even watch Dr. Phil. I thought, how sad. How do people find a rehab that even works? It just so happened that the guy that was working there is the one who pointed us to where he ended up, because he had gotten sober there. And he honestly, it was amazing, because he did not talk us into sending him there. He said, can I call you after work? And literally said, Jared's story sounds like mine. I think he should go where I got sober. And one of the interesting things about talking to them is there are places that will tell you it's beautiful facilities and you have a chef, and that's not what they need. They cook their own meals. They learned the basic details of accountability and responsibility. Like, you got to show up on time, and on time means 5 minutes early, and you got to dress nice, and you got to be clean, and you got to be respectful, and you have to cook for yourself, and you have to have a clean room. And I thought, it is that basic with them. They have to relearn how to be responsible and accountable in life. And when I talked to them, we had a great admissions counselor. She was talking to me, because it took us several months to get him there because he was in jail. She was very helpful. And I said, because is this a good program? I don't know. What makes up a good program? And they talked about the fact that they did have EMDR. They had a psychiatrist that he could meet with. They had, equine therapy. They had all kinds of, you know, they had yoga classes and all those kinds of things. But when you get there, it's not a fancy facility in any means. And I think that what we do to get them to go often is choose some place that was really nice. When I first talked to him, I go, hey, I found this place, and it's in the Pacific, you know, and it's on the ocean, and you get a cottage by the, and I'm thinking, Jesus, what an idiot. When I look back, I'm like, I want to make sure you're comfortable, which is the opposite of what they need to learn. They need to learn to be uncomfortable, though.
And one of the things that I hear families say is, well, they get to go away and they get to work on themselves. And yeah. I'm still here holding the bag.
Yeah.
You know, I'm cleaning up the mess or taking care of this. Mm. What would you say to families about that situation? What does the family need to be doing while their loved one is working on themselves?
Well, and I told them, you know, I've told people, first of all, don't clean up all their messes. I used to pay off his debts thinking, you know, got to keep his credit score good. It's so, you know, it's something I could control, right? And trying to, you know, clean up the messes. And I think that once they go, what I've told families is, you know, if they're in a 12-step program, you definitely want to go to Al-Anon to understand that. You need to understand the language and you need to understand what they're going through. And I think you should seek your own, everybody's different. You need to try a lot of different things, but self-care and not cleaning up their mess, take a break. Do not fix their credit score. Do not fix the messes. I mean, I had law enforcement calling me, you would have all of that. And I would say, doesn't live here. I don't know who that is. You finally had to get to where you stopped. And you have to take that time when they go and treat yourself to the vacation you never took, to a staycation, if that's what it is, therapy, Al-Anon, going and seeing your friends again. And, you know, it's so simple, but laughter and, you know, family, and you have to reconnect. It tears families apart. You don't intend that, but you spend so much time on that one problem that spouses are not as close and your other kids. And I had a lady that said, you know, my daughter's been pregnant through this whole thing and it's my first grandchild. I said, let him go and go be with your daughter. You know, that you can't make a visitation. You've made 500 of them at different rehabs. So what? Spend some time and refocus on your family and yourself and your friends, because you give up so much to just try to fix this. And again, it's so isolating that you don't really want to drag people into it. But there's a lot of anger, even though you don't want to be angry at them. And you've got to find some outlet to deal with all of that. Whatever it is, don't feel, you know, that it's selfish to take care of yourself and your family and your friends. I think that's so critical because I remember people would say it aged you 10 years, you know, just it feels that way. It's such a weight and it's not yours to fix. But they only have one you. And if you're the one who supported getting them there, if you're not healthy and taking care of yourself, you know, you're not going to be much good to them. So it's just, it feels funny to do. I always felt like there was something I was supposed to be fixing. And so I tell people just to breathe, just breathe.
So Jared, when your mom lost her job as the fixer and started breathing, and you went to the ranch and began to get well, there's a really poignant scene in the book to where you're both at graduation and the counselor calls you aside. What were you saying you had learned? Lisa just shared what she had learned. What had you learned at that point?
At the end of the day, I mean, what I really wanted and what I learned is like that I could be a productive family member, right? I could actually give back something, which is something that I enjoy to this day, like being able to be here for my family. But like, I mean, what I really learned in the end was just how selfish I was, even though I didn't view myself that way. But like being able to work through the 12 steps and doing inventory and all that stuff is just being able to see like the damage that I caused, really just opened my eyes a lot. Especially with Tatum when she spoke at my graduation, that was a spiritual experience to be had, because I didn't know, she rarely ever talks about how it affected her at all. So like being able to see her do that in front of a bunch of people was eye-opening as well. It's just like you get all these reinforcements of the damage you've done, these little hints, these little conversations, these little things that show up where you're like, wow, man, I had a bigger impact than I thought I did, you know, and like being able to refocus my my energy and like my viewpoint, and reaching out to like my brothers and my mom and my stepdad and my daughter, and like just being able to be there for them is it's completely shifted in that sense. You know, I think that I show up as a way better family member, obviously, than I did before. So like that's what I'm grateful for now, is like I was grateful to be in a position that I could go to the treatment center that I went to, which I know not everybody gets. So when I think back of like all the stuff that I've been through, it's just like nothing but gratitude at this point, right? It's like I am grateful for the life that I have now, and I'm glad that I had to go through all that stuff, because I get to, you know, talk to people like you, right? And to families that still are struggling. And, you know, that's really the point of all of this thing, the point of this book and point of these conversations, right, is to show support and let people know that you're not alone. That's a big deal.
Thank you both for being here. And the book is Before There Was an After by Lisa Mead and Jared Davis. Lisa, Jared just gave us some wonderful things that he's grateful for on the day before Thanksgiving. What are you grateful for?
You know, it's definitely, I'm learning to just be, and always been grateful for family, but you never know what's going to happen, and to savor those small moments, like our mother-son Thanksgiving dinner tomorrow, that, you know, being disappointed that things don't go exactly the way you picture or think they should, I think is such a waste of time. I was such a perfectionist and wanting everything to be a certain way, that I'm learning to be grateful for just being here, people being alive, going through addiction changes your whole view of that. I'm grateful for small conversations and good food and just time. I think that's what we were talking about this morning. It's just time together, and you know, don't take it for granted. You just never know what's going to happen. And I think we both learned enormous gratitude of the small things in life. So, and we're grateful for you for having us on. We certainly would like to spread any support we can to families, and, you know, and hope. I think I learned an enormous amount about hope, and there's always hope if you don't give up and you refocus. And again, remember the important things. It's not what you look like to the world. It's just those intimate moments with family, I think, and friends that are so critical. And helping anyone, if any conversation we can have can help one person. When I asked him about the book, that's what he said. I said, gosh, you know, I'm so driven. I'm like, I forgot to ever ask you, is this hard for you? He said, if it can help one person, then it's worth it. And I think that that's what we've learned, is to, you can't just experience this and keep it to yourself. I think you have to go out and help and support people like you're doing. I think it's really critical to be able to tell your story and let people know they're not alone.
Well, thank you both for being here, taking the time to do this, because I know it's important for you to be together, and that Tatum is wandering around somewhere. I'm sure you want to be with her. So thank you both.
Thank you, Tanya.
Thanks for having us.
Happy Thanksgiving.
You, beloved listener, are creative, resourceful, and whole. Do you want to add more purpose to your sober journey? Do you want to make room for the new and make your dreams a reality? Apply today for a dream session. Go to tanyajoya.com. That's TanyaGioia.com, and apply today. Let's get you dreaming about your new purpose.